In the studio this morning, I have Nikki Hare, who lectures in the Department of Psychology at the University of Auckland here in New Zealand. And I just wish to say kia ora and welcome to the show.
Kia ora, Tim. Great to be here.
Nikki, can you give a little background as to how you have involved yourself in the psychology of sustainability?
When I first started in psychology, I was doing research on traffic safety. And I've always been interested in issues around well-being, how to get people healthier and happier and issues like that. Got a long background in social justice, come from a family that's really interested in those kind of issues. And then maybe 5 or 6 years ago, I woke up to the idea that there was an environment around us and that we better do something to get ourselves in sync with that environment. So I consider myself a rather latecomer to the green movement. And it was really because I hadn't put together all the pieces as to how important it was. So increasingly over the last few years, I've seen that it's really the most pressing issue of our time. And it seems to me it's also the most exciting issue of our time. I sort of can't imagine why I'd be want to be doing something else when this is the thing that's sort of glaring us in the face and needs to be dealt with. So I've increasingly got students on board and got involved in projects that relate to issues of sustainability, issues of citizenship, how to engage people in this, and not just like save the planet, but also save the individuals who are doing it. That is, I strongly believe that acting this way makes you happier and healthier while you're doing it. And of course, hopefully it'll create a better society for people in the future.
Because once you get team spirit moving, all sorts of innovative ideas come in. You find that?
Absolutely. I mean, people are not individuals in the sense that we often imagine. Like, all of our thoughts are created by what's inside us now, but also how we're interacting. So you and I are co-creating information as during this interview. And so bringing together people who are like-minded is one of the most exciting things you can do. And one of the projects I've been working on, both in my personal life and in my university life, is looking at transition town activists. So we've got a transition town in Point Shep where I live, and basically it's a whole lot of people coming together who are concerned about what's going on, but also just want to live differently in the here and now. They just want to live. We want to live in a more community-oriented way. We want to have input into the politics of our city and our country. We want to connect with each other. We want to eat organic food. And these are just sort of short-term goals in a way. And when you bring together people like that and you start to think about ideas and what you can do, it just feels fantastic at that personal level. It just feels really good. So as a psychologist in my academic life, I'm also interested in working out what it is about that that feels good, why it feels good. And it seems to me that the collective people working together is this enormously human thing to do. As people, I think we have a few basic desires and tendencies and whatever, but possibly the strongest thing underpinning it all is a desire to connect with others. You put the average person on a desert island and that is the equivalent of hell. People just don't want to be like that. So you put people together who are getting these sort of warm connections with other people, and that is one of the best experiences you can have. It also creates new ideas, new outcomes, and new possibilities.
What I have found is meeting new people, and you really think, wow, that person's fantastic. They've got so many abilities. They're gregarious. They know how to pull all these things together. I've always been impressed with who's just out there who we've never, ever met before.
Oh, totally. I mean, like, our transition town, the biggest group is the gardening group, and people love getting together and talking about when to plant their cabbages and how to deal with the snails and everything else. Now, I'm not in the garden group, as it happens, because I don't garden. But I sort of am so impressed with the fact that people know how to do this. And now in Point Shep, our backyard garden, which my husband actually looks after, but we eat 90% of our vegetables come from that garden. There's just so much out there, and all these people. The way a lot of people live, you drive through your suburb, you really don't know who's out there and what they can offer. But transition towns is a way of just connecting that, and it's very exciting to be part of it.
Nikki, your most recent research addresses issues of sustainability, citizenship and political activism. Can you take us through a deeper level of that?
Yeah, okay. Well, one of the things I'm very interested in is why people work for the common good. And I've also always been interested in young people. So the traffic safety research, which I started out with and mentioned a while ago, was mostly focused on young people, why they take risks on the road. And then I realised it was all really negative. It was like, why do people take risks? How do we stop people from doing this? And I sort of started to find that I just didn't really want to be working in that kind of way so much anymore. So I shifted my focus initially into the idea of citizenship and sustainability around young people that are working for the common good. And I've got really interested in the idea of positive youth development, which is the Ministry of Youth Development strategy, and I think it's a really good way of looking at it. So it's not about all the things young people do wrong, but it's about what are the things young people are doing right and how can we create more of that kind of stuff. What occurred to me is the sustainability field is one way in which young people can get really involved, and I became very interested in the young people who want to get involved in this. And I'm working on a project with several university students and the students at Western Springs College, and we're working towards creating sustainability at the school. So some of that is really practical stuff, like we've had this very cool project getting new waste stations in place. So we've had students paint panels in all sorts of creative ways. So these waste stations, which hopefully will be in place in about a month because they're already ready but not just put together, they'll look fantastic. They'll make everybody think, wow, this school's really onto something. They get waste sorted because each station's got compost and recycling as well as a landfill bin. The landfill bin's going to be black and discouraged, of course, because we want food scraps and recycling, and we don't really want people to bring the waste to school that has to end up in landfill. So, but one of the key things we've been really interested in that process is these young people, the student leaders and the other young people that want to get involved in these projects. How do you get them involved? What kinds of young people are attracted to doing these sorts of projects, and what are they getting out of it? And it's been really great at the school this year because the young people, the student leaders, have been fantastic and really well connected, and they've got all their friends along, and we've helped with things like food. We always give food. We make sure the food's ideally organic and homemade and low packaging, although I have to admit we've had some pizzas because we've had such massive numbers to some things that it's quite difficult to fully provide it like that. But nevertheless, the pizza boxes go to the worms to eat afterwards. So we've been bringing together these young people and really trying to work out what it is about them. And one of the key things for young people is a family background in this area. So it's just that much easier to get involved if your family is doing these kinds of things. And we're seeing that as quite a strong emphasis. But it's also in itself so sort of fulfilling and positive, being able to affect actual change in the environment, having other people respect you and look at what you're doing, having the adults around you respond positively to these things. They all sort of really help young people's growth. Still, I think it's interesting that many young people are in quite an egocentric phase in their life. It is pretty difficult to, as a young person, to sort of disconnect from the fact that you need to get a career and you need to get a relationship and there's all those other things going on. So I think it's still quite unusual for a young person to throw themselves holus bolus into this. Also had a fantastic student leader last year at the school who was really special in terms of her commitment to this. But as I get older, and Tim, I think you're probably a little bit older like me as well, not, it's like psychologically there is a change to this more generativity concept, they call it, whereby for people like us, the idea of having a career and finding a relationship, well, we've done those things or we know those things are impossible or whatever it is, we've resolved ourselves. So we're more naturally, in a sense, focused on the idea of giving back. For young people, I think that's a slightly harder thing to be focused on, but nevertheless, a lot of them are doing that kind of thing.
With the young ones, they're doing all the physical things by separating. Are they using any other technologies to share their ideas?
Yeah, well, with the waste station project that I was talking about, we're going to have in place these waste stations, which are an environmental cue, if you like, to the school, that waste needs to be separated in this way. But we've got a whole lot of other things going on as well to try and change thinking about waste. One of the things, one of my students, university students, is a filmmaker, and she's managed to drag heaps of her friends, other students from the university and others, who've given like hours and hours of time, whole weekend days, to making a film We've already made one film to try and just generate the idea of sustainability at the school. But Charlotte and her team are making another film, which will have all the students involved from the school as well. And that's going to be about what waste means and how to use waste. And it's going to be modelling the idea of minimising waste and putting waste into the correct bins. Because one of the kind of interesting ideas to come out of psychology, I'm always interested when there's a theoretical psychology idea that matches practice, is that people are great copiers. People like to model their behaviour on what they see around them. And a lot of this is actually quite automatic. We've got these things called mirror neurons in our brain that mean that if I see you doing something, like moving your hand, some neurons in my brain will light up in the same way that the neurons in your brain are doing so. So it's almost as if I am kind of literally reading your mind through your actions, through this sort of transmission of your actions, specifically firing off neurons in my brain. So how this all ends up relating to waste and bins is that if we're constantly showing people the bad stuff, like if we're, a lot of these environmental films, they focus on what people are doing wrong, and in traffic safety, there's still a lot of traffic safety advertisements out there that show a crash, and that's the primary focus. What's happening to us as humans when we watch these things is we might be thinking, oh, that's risky, that's bad, I want to do it, don't want to do it, I want to avoid it, I want to save the planet to get it. But and another level, what our brains are doing is we're learning bad behaviour. We're seeing it and we're sort of absorbing it as the most normal thing to do. So this film that Charlotte's making in relation to the waste station bins is going to very clearly show the kind of good behaviours, the things that we're after, show students with waste-free lunches, show students putting things into the right bin, because in the end, what we want to model is that behaviour that just sort of then gets taken on and absorbed as part of the way these young people are. So film is one of the technologies that we're using to try and encourage this shift in the school. And we're not interested in a superficial shift at the school. Like, I mean, it's fantastic that they put their waste in the right place. We want that. But we're after the big stuff here. We want the young people to take on identities around sustainability, to feel like this is a school at which we are sustainable, it's what we stand for. And then the young people then go out into other communities and they're primed and ready for any opportunities to be sustainable in those communities. So if they enter a workplace where there's a program to maybe to reduce car use, they'll say, yeah, I'm with that, because they've got this mindset that that's an important and great way to be.
It's a difficult one because the media are always pushing for them to go individual and have as many accumulated assets or things.
Absolutely.
It's a difficult one, isn't it?
Yeah. Mm. I mean, I think as a psychologist, I'm completely convinced that well-being focuses around a few really basic things. Belonging. I've already talked about how I think, you know, people just absolutely want warm human relationships. A sense of being effective. People want to feel that what they do has an effect on the world. That varies from, I want to be able to drive my car so I can know how to do that. I want to be able to grow a garden so I know how to do that. We don't want to pour our energies into activities that we can't do that are going nowhere. So we want to be effective. We want to belong. But we really want this thing called integrity, which is the sense that I can be who I am. And it's a slightly elusive thing, but psychologists have still managed to measure it. And if you ask people about any activity they're involved in, like their work, their hobbies, their relationships, the greatest predictor of whether they will continue with that is whether they indicate that it feels that this is me. Does your job feel like it is you? If the person says yes, they'll probably still be in it in 5 years. If they say no, they'll be struggling to get out of it. It's a really, really strong indicator of continuation. So when you look at things like money and status and having lots of stuff, sometimes that can signify these things, like I'm effective because I earn $200,000 a year or whatever, but it's not the core of it. So somehow we've talked ourselves into this picture that human well-being is about having lots of things, it's about being endlessly able to move around, like the transportation we have to be able to get instantly from one place to another, and it's like our right to be able to do that. And yet if you look at what people really nourishes people, it's actually these really simple things. And you don't need to use huge numbers of the planet resources to get them. You can feel affected by earning $200,000 a year, but if the maximum salary in a society is $50,000 a year, you're going to feel really effective if you've reached that. We love computers. They first came out, they get upgraded and upgraded and upgraded. Our old screen, like I can see you've got here, one of those screens that's still got that big back to it, starts to seem old-fashioned and not very good, whereas when it was new, it was the latest, hottest thing. So I think everybody kind of knows intellectually and intuitively that these things aren't where it's at, and they're so resource-using. So my ideal society would have people on street corners playing their guitars, playing chess, people out there in the environment doing stuff in this real community sense. You'd still want to have, I personally would still want my own room and my own house where I can hide away from that. But imagine walking out your door, strolling down your street, there's some people playing chess on the corner, there's kids kicking a ball around because there's either no cars or the cars are moving incredibly slowly, where there's a little place where you can buy a cup of tea and sit there and drink your tea with people coming and going. You can learn how to do a new skill because there's plenty of people around that are able to do it. You can get up late, get up early because the amount of hours you're sort of working in terms of the normal economy as we see it these days is less. I mean, that to me is paradise. And we can do all that now with what we've got.
I agree with you. I definitely agree. So how do you engage people in creating a more sustainable and equitable society? Can you give us some real good sort of foundations so that listeners can work towards this?
Yeah. Well, I think there's lots of kind of levels of people. I've been mostly interested in people that want to be part of the process. So I've been mostly myself interested in people that are sitting there just dying to get involved, maybe that currently are involved, but their energy tapers, waxes and wanes. And so I think with those people that really want to get involved, it's a matter of understanding that you will be working, you will be connecting with people, and that's the first tip. So that if you want to be a person making changes, try and connect with other people for two reasons. One is that you'll be more effective. So if you want to change something like get buses into your area, a group of you is going to be more effective than one of you. So that's one reason. But the other reason is it's just so much more nourishing. It just keeps you going because of this human desire to belong. I think there are lots of great books out there which I think you can read and which can help connect you to the process, and there's lots of great websites, radio stations and interviews. You know, I think collecting around you all these human products that make you feel that this is a worthwhile thing to do and that you should be doing it, and trying to avoid the kind of negativity, I think is really important, because this helps you feel committed and motivated, and it's just the basic way to go if you want to achieve anything, and especially with the sustainability stuff. I think the harder thing is how you get people who are not those kind of central ones but are sort of more on the periphery. And I think this is where a lot of this sort of mass behavioural change things start to come into play potentially, where you get things like environmental cues. So at the school, for example, we're going to have these waste stations, and they're going to have different colours for different recycling, landfill and food scraps, and those will be a massive environmental cue. So the majority of kids, even if they're not that interested, once they get into the school culture, will probably, hopefully, simply put stuff in the right bins, because it's just what you do. So that's the kind of environmental triggers which are really important when you're thinking about the mass kind of scale. But I also really believe that you can convert is a dangerous word to use, because then people will get into the religious thing, but you can get people on board, which is probably a safer way of putting it, still by these interpersonal interactions. I mean, what's changed your life? Like, what's changed my life? I started riding my bike to work because I was at the Greyland Festival, and I saw a stand of Cycle Action Auckland, and I talked to somebody who actually rode his bike from Greyland to university. Well, I live in Point Sherwood, and I thought, hey, it's possible. It's a one-on-one human connection that got me to shift that little bit. And so I still think that even on the massive scale, one of the key things is those one-on-one interactions. So if you want to be a change agent, you can work at that sort of mass behaviour change level with things like environmental cues, but you can also work at the just being who you are, making who you are quite visible, and then some of the people around you, some of that will rub off on people just on this one-by-one kind of thing. And then the change becomes exponential. So I affect one person, and then now there's two of us, right? So the two of us each affects somebody else, and then there's four of us, and then you get eight, and then you just kind of grows like that. Especially if the things you're bringing about ultimately connect to human well-being. So if they're not really sacrifices, I mean, like riding my bike is something that I know is pretty unusual behavior for a woman in her 40s in Auckland, going into central Auckland. I know that's not a common thing to do. And a lot of me is motivated by the feeling that I'm contributing to reduced fossil fuel emissions and all of that. But it's also a really enjoyable way to get around. And if it wasn't enjoyable, and if it wasn't giving me physical fitness, so it's giving me those sort of personal benefits and those psychological benefits, then I probably wouldn't do it. It's got to, people aren't going to be motivated over the long term by things that just feel like painful. They just won't do it. So there's no point in getting people to do painful things. But there's a lot of myths out there about what's painful and what's not. I know that cycling is often seen as painful. Well, it isn't, I can tell you that. And buying food at the supermarket versus growing your own. Well, gardening is one of the most enjoyable activities, I believe. I don't do it, but people talk about it. It kind of changes their lives, like a stress reducer and everything like that. So that's a kind of long answer to that question, but as with anything, how you get people on board, there's multiple strategies. Yeah. And one of the things I really sincerely believe in is that this relates to the idea of complexity theory, which is the concept that we're in these systems in which everything's interacting all the time, and you can't predict what those interactions are going to result in. So I can't sit here and say to you, the solution is social, transition towns will change the world. And equally, nobody can sit here and say to you, Tim, the solution is technological, we just need to do this. I mean, all of these are just ideas.
Parts of a whole.
Yeah. And we all tell our story about what we think will work. But I sincerely believe that who knows what will work, if anything, but everything should be embraced, unless it's like really obviously destructive in the short term, like it's hurting people, or, you know, there's no good reason why it should work. Okay, let's not do those things. But anything that seems feasible and is in good faith, it's people trying hard to do stuff, let's embrace that. Let's like say, go for it. Let's not say, oh no, that's no good because blah, 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 blah. I get really frustrated when I hear sometimes people saying, well, what's the point in supermarkets charging for plastic bags? Because there's all this other plastic packaging in the supermarket. So it's all just a greenwashing, total, nah, it's not real, it's not good, forget it, it's a bad thing. Well, hang on, let's think about that. Okay, maybe it even is greenwashing. But do you want to be the one that says, now this is silly, I'm going to buy lots of plastic bags to show them it's not going to change my behaviour? You know, what sort of message is that sending? What I try and think is, any little edge into this, I'm going to support, because I want to send the message that I care. So if a supermarket gets reductions in people using plastic bags through whatever strategy they're putting in place, then they'll sit around and say, hey, people actually care about this. Maybe the next step is whatever it is. And maybe it won't work. But we can't predict in advance what'll work and what'll not work. We just have to go with those things that feel like they might work.
I'm speaking with Nikki Hare, who lectures at the Department of Psychology here at the University of Auckland. And Nikki, your most substantial work to date is the book Carbon Neutral by 2020. You and many others want New Zealand to become carbon neutral by this particular date, 2020, which is fast coming. It's about how New Zealanders can tackle climate change, and you co-edited with Quentin Atkinson. And in it, you include 14 chapters by experts on how New Zealand can take on this carbon challenge. Can you tell the listeners more about this?
Well, the book started at the University of Auckland. We realised there were so many people at the university that just knew heaps of stuff around sustainability, and that we were all really aware that climate change was one of the biggest issues. At that time, Helen Clark had been speaking about a carbon neutral nation, and we thought, well, let's just see how feasible this is. Let's get behind this idea of New Zealand being carbon neutral. So Quentin and I started ringing people, and we just found that practically everyone we asked to write a chapter said yes. It was quite extraordinary. We sent out an email to Craig Potten Publishing. They got back to me immediately and said they were interested in publishing it. So it was just something that had this really quick and fast momentum. The idea originated in about December, I think. We started getting authors in February, and it was published in November of that year. So it was a very fast process, basically because the knowledge was already out there. And in the book, we talk about the issue from multiple perspectives. We got experts on housing, on transport issues, on schools, on investment, on political activism, and multiple other chapters. I haven't got it right in front of me, so I can't quote them all. But they vary a bit in terms of whether it's about the individual and what you do in your own house and in your own life, as to whether it's something that councils could be involved in, or whether it's something we can be involved in as a nation. And the ultimate aim of it all is this idea of, wouldn't it be just so amazing to live in a country in which one of our biggest focuses was on being green and on, in this particular case, on reducing carbon emissions. And one of the things that was so amazing for me doing this book is meeting and talking with all these incredibly interesting people and learning so much. One of the things I learnt about was how the carbon cycle works, which may seem rather odd that somebody who was editing this book didn't fully appreciate that. But I didn't really realise that carbon was absorbed into trees. I mean, I knew that in theory, but when you actually look at trees, they've got these fabulous trunks that are just solid carbon, and these roots that penetrate into the soil and indeed rich with carbon. And the soil is a potential holder of so much carbon. And the way in which we use our land, both our agricultural land and the land on which we live, so affects the amount of carbon that we're storing outside of the atmosphere, because those carbon atoms have got to be somewhere. They're either up there in the air doing at the moment bad stuff, or they're in the soil, or they're in the trees, or they're in the oceans. They're always somewhere. So it gave me this huge appreciation where I just sort of walked around kind of really valuing that living stuff, and then looking at great areas of tarmac and thinking, this is such a problem because we're smothering the potential for this for the carbon cycle to work in the way that it's most effective. I think I also came to appreciate waste in a whole different way, you see, and a lot of this is in our gardening chapter in our book, because waste is another thing. What is waste? I've heard other people say there is no away. And what I realise is in the way we live now, waste is something that is produced and dealt with entirely outside of the system in which it is produced. So this goes right from like human waste, our bodily waste is sanitised and taken away and like wasted. All the nutrients in that are not properly dealt with because we're putting all these other things into the system, because we're taking it a long way from where it is produced and so on. And I don't think before I started the book that I had such a strong idea of how you can have systems in which all of these things are just far more effectively utilised, and that by creating societies in which we're producing and consuming through these incredibly complex relationships, which everybody's sort of long since forgotten how they work, we've sort of really lost touch with the basics of nature, which is often called like the basics of science, these basic principles of how things work, and this idea that we actually are in a closed system in which everything ends up somewhere and ends up being reused, and we need to just think about how we want that to work and what our role is in making that work optimally for the way things are. One of the things that I think is kind of interesting about the current debate is that I have to admit that one of the things I used to think, and I suspect there's a lot of people out there that still think it, is that this green stuff and environmentalism is sort of, it's religious and it's kind of airy-fairy and it's anti-science and all the rest of it. And I used to have little bits of that because I'd look at some things, like some medical things, and still scares me when people claim that alternative therapies can cure you. And I think there's a lot of dangerous things said out there and claims made. And I think some of the things that are said about organics are actually probably not quite right. And so we have to be careful about overclaiming for these kind of things. But what I think has happened more recently is that many of these ideas, like holistic views of the person and the body and of how systems work, things like organic food, are now really strongly backed by scientific principles. And so it's interesting that the science and environmentalism movements have come together very, very strongly of late. And as a scientist, in the sense that I work within a science faculty at the university, that makes me really, really comfortable in this field in a way that I might not have been 10 years ago, because I just didn't understand the degree to which all this is just simply based on the way the world works.
Nikki, can you give a few examples of some of the chapters? Because each one, I noticed you've got the Earth Charter,
yeah,
by Klaus Bosselmann. That's underpinning everything, really, isn't it?
Yeah, I mean, it's the thing underpinning it is this desire to live within the bounds of nature, the desire to put, it really is just a reality check in a way, but there's all sorts of other principles underlying our book too, which is the idea of human well-being at the deepest level. So that, as I said, we need to live within nature, but what do we mean by live? Like, what is living? And the authors of our book also believe that we need to look at, well, actually I shouldn't say that because I can't speak for every single author individually, but one of the strong themes in our book is that you need to have social justice as well in all of this. And again, there's part of that is a sort of moral, philosophical point of view, if you like, that we just think that it's good that people are treated in a way that's just and fair. But it's also really practical, because history has shown us that if you oppress people, they don't just stay oppressed forever. They just don't say, yeah, I'm happy to work in your sweatshop for the next 100 years. Of course they don't. They look for better alternatives. They also want to be in control of their lives. They also want to live in cities close to their families rather than having to go 200 miles away to work in some factory, because everybody wants to live close to their family. So it's not like these humans that we feel as we're entitled to pay 1/100th of what we earn will just put up with that forever. So even from a purely practical point of view, to me, social justice is something we need to get our heads around. So a truly sustainable society will involve nourishing and working within the planet, because that's just a physical given, and it will also involve working within human nature and encouraging well-being, because there's another sense in which that is also simply a physical given. It is just simply true of human beings that you need to nourish them in order for them to be in harmony with you. I mean, things like war, extraordinarily destructive, whoever's taking part. So do we want to create a system in which there will continue to be war because people will be angry with other people because they're not, or they feel they're not getting their just desserts? Or do we want to create a system in which we've sort of worked out how to negotiate these things with each other? And part of that, I'm absolutely convinced, is that you have to feel fairly treated. I mean, another kind of absurdity in all of this, of course, is that nobody, and I've already gone over this, but it probably deserves a little bit of restating, is that those extremes of wealth and the extremes of resource use centred on some individuals who have got this amazing social power, those individuals aren't getting like 500 times more happiness from this or something. They wouldn't cease to be entrepreneurs if we didn't give them all this extraordinary wealth. This idea that creativity is driven by making lots of money is just bizarre. People are creative and expressive and make these amazing differences because it's who they are and it's who they want to be. And we almost seem to live in a society that's scared of things like high taxes and scared of not paying CEOs $2 million because then they won't do the work. Well, I just don't believe that's true. So what underlies our book is not only the sort of basic physics and biology and mechanics of how you'd bring about a carbon neutral society, but the social and values based position. But again, I don't want to say values as if these come from like nowhere. They're still really, really grounded in the way that humans function and societies function. And the Earth Charter is one of the basis for that that's within the book.
Nikki, with global finances in crisis and ecological disturbances building up, with transition towns in particular here in New Zealand, do you think New Zealanders are somewhat complacent?
I think most people just don't understand what's going on. I think probably actually nobody understands what's going on in the fullest sense of the word. But I think it's, I mean, people have got a lot to deal with. When I was talking before about young people, right, what are they really interested in? They're most worried about getting a partner, getting a relationship, and then they're interested in getting some kind of career, getting some kind of house. And we look at them, and I look at them, I've got a daughter, and I work with young people, and I get that. You know, I get why for them dealing with those issues takes pretty much most of their energy. And so when you think about adults who are supposedly kind of beyond all of that, they're still dealing with small issues in relation to their lives. Their relationship isn't very good. They've got their career in crisis. Their car's broken down. There's just so much going on. And then they listen to the news and it's all incredibly confusing because somebody says something and somebody else says something else. And in terms of the financial thing, I mean, what's so intriguing about that is that financial growth is always packed with metaphors of green shoots and things being brighter on the horizon. So we're told that it's good that house prices are going up, when I have never understood, because to me that's got to be bad, because how do people afford houses if these prices are going up all the time? So I guess what I'm trying to get at here is, are we too complacent? Well, I think everybody is struggling to do their best to live, and I think it's kind of difficult to expect people to sort of drop those everyday concerns and get behind something without the leadership, without the media, without the sort of force of things pushing them along that way. I mean, even I, who think of myself as an eco-warrior, will go days where my biggest concerns are how to get to work and back, whether somebody at work still likes me, getting home in time to watch a TV program I really want to see. So here am I, supposedly with all this enlightenment, still able to get really kind of bogged down by these issues. So I think, I mean, I would love to see a daily report on the state of the environment. Like, I turn on, listen to the national station, and what do I get? I get the sports news, and there's a lot of it, actually.
Too much of it.
A lot, yeah. Well, I never really listen to it. That's when I just sort of zone out and think about what I'm going to cook for dinner or whatever. I get the financial news, which just says, always got these enormous emotional overlays. You know, some things are good and some things are bad, and there's a lot of that. When do I get the environmental news? When do I get what the current carbon dioxide levels are in the atmosphere, carbon equivalents? When do I hear that? When do I hear about whether some river's been polluted or unpolluted? When do I get that? I would like an environmental report, Radio New Zealand, take note, on the hour, every hour, just the way I get a weather report, I get a financial report, I get a sports report. And these are the ways in which you can start to change how overall people are viewing these things. I don't kind of bring it down to individuals. I think we need to think about the way we present these things. And I'm desperately jealous of the Scandinavian countries, where I actually listened again on the national station to an interview about somebody who had written a book about Norway. And I thought, this is sounds so fabulous, where as a country they sort of accept that what they're trying to do is protect the environment, increase social programs, get everybody on board, people that have got issues and unhappiness in their lives. And what do we want to be? We want to be as rich as Australia. I mean, what kind of goal is that? It breaks my heart that we see ourselves as that's the best we can do, be as rich as Australia. Oh my goodness. So I think New Zealanders might be complacent, but they're complacent only because they've got so much that's filling their heads. And every human is susceptible to that, like even me.
So what are the most urgent actions people can involve themselves after listening to you and this program?
Well, there's a lot of things I think people can do. I guess in a nutshell, I think you look for opportunities and you support those opportunities. And one of the things I think is really interesting is how much you're an initiator and how much you're a supporter of actions. And I think both of those are really, really critical. So if you're in a workplace where you could initiate something like, say, having glass cups instead of having plastic cups at events, that's fantastic. But if anyone else puts up their hand and says they want to have bike parking somewhere, be the person that says, yes, that's a great idea. Don't be the person that says, but that's impractical because it would get rid of this car park, or because the bikes would be stolen, or because nobody bikes anyway. So be the yes person when it comes to other people's ideas. And when you can initiate your own ideas, do that too. I'm a great believer in change at the organisational level. I think that we can change at the individual level, and I and most of the people I know that are interested in this try and align our lives more and more and more with the practices we believe in. But none of us do it perfectly. We all put some things above our sort of eco principles. I'm not saying that's good, but that's just the way it is. But I think at the organisational level that you can bring about some really fundamental stuff that starts to sort of leak into the bigger world. So if you work for an organisation, I work for the University of Auckland, I mean, that's an enormous organisation, and I'm really excited about the fact that we've just recently got a grant to look at all the teaching and research related to sustainability at the university and to really start to pull together these things. We've got an environmental coordinator who's also looking at various practices within the institution. Now, if I can affect how the University of Auckland operates within the New Zealand context, that's potentially really substantial. The university is linked to all the other universities, all the other tertiary institutions. If they start to get on board, like, how cool is that? That's massive. If you work for Telecom, if you work for Vodafone, if you work for Air New Zealand, these are massive institutions. But even if you work for a small business, that business is networked into other businesses. So I think one of the really important things individuals can do is work at the organisational level to change practices, things like where you buy your goods from, how you get around, transportation is huge. So do what you can at the individual level. Within all the organisations you're connected to, do what you can. And the other thing, I think, is to see yourself as a political agent and to think about things like your local Member of Parliament, think about things like the local authorities. There are consultation processes going on all the time. And, I mean, there's been a whole flurry of things recently because of things like cuts to enviro schools and community education and various things that I have been pretty involved in myself. Not the cuts, of course, but protesting the cuts. So there's numerous opportunities. All the councils have got long-term plans, they've got short-term plans, they have consultation here, there and everywhere. You and your mates get together, do submissions, be part of those plans, because there's so many people not doing anything that if you do something, join together with other people, this is what will make a difference. And I think part of it too is understanding that your role is almost certainly small, maybe even insignificant. And I know that in this individualist society in which we love to tell people that whatever you do will work and will make a difference and one person can change the world and all that kind of stuff. But I'm not going to say that because I don't really believe it. I think it's possible, but you probably won't be the person that does that. You will probably be the person that just adds your little piece, supporting other people's initiatives, carrying out some of your own initiatives. That may be the piece that does it. It probably won't be the piece that does it. But you will have lived this kind of life along the way. And what would you rather be doing? Would you rather be working with people, building a community garden, or would you be rather watching the cricket on TV? So it's a bit of a matter to me of how you want to spend your time, who you want to hang out with, the kind of world you want to create around you, and then the hope that all of that will add to the big picture of having some kind of massive effect. But to me, it's a matter of keeping going in a state of uncertainty about how it's all going to end up. And I don't know how you resolve that entirely, because I can sometimes feel overwhelmed by that. I think part of being human is to sometimes be overwhelmed by that. But then you just get together with your mates and you're inspired again.
I agree. Team spirit. And in finishing, Nikki, how do you see it all happening in New Zealand? What's your positive vision? 2020. What will happen in 2020?
The thing that I'd love to happen is that, say, with these, you know, all these climate change issues and so many New Zealanders coming out in force at Nick Smith's consultations saying 40% reductions is what we should be aiming for the next round of the agreements from the Copenhagen Agreement. Like, my fantasy is that the government and the people will sort of get it, that we could be a nation that led this process. So let's just imagine that happens. And let's just imagine that our nation decides to take that on as a challenge. So by 2020, what would we have? Well, here in Auckland, we'd have the most amazing public transport system. We'd have much reduced car use. We'd have neighbourhoods that were lively. We'd have maybe some of our roads ripped up, or at least trees growing down the middle of them to get that carbon cycle working properly again. We'd have people really connecting with each other. We'd have a reduced working week, but everybody would have work because there'd be more to go around and fewer people to have it. Our schools would be back with Enviro Schools programs and kids doing all of this stuff and learning how to be citizens, learning how to engage, learning how the world works. That would be my vision for 2020.
In community gardens and sort of farmers markets in the city.
Absolutely. I mean, there's a farmers market starting in Greyland next month. I can't wait. You know, to me, you go to the supermarket and it's a place with no, it's got no karma or mana or whatever word you want to use. It hasn't got it, you know. You go to a farmers market and that's the person that grew the stuff. And the interaction doesn't just buy you the thing. It buys you a piece of human warmth. And it's a whole, it's just a whole different deal. It's this nourishment of the soul, basically.
Nikki, thank you very much. Have you a website that you can put us on to?
No, I don't, actually. I mean, you can look me up on the university website where I have something through the psychology department, but I don't have my own personal website, but I would encourage you to look up Transition Towns, transitiontowns.org.nz. You can find our Point Chev Transition Town on there. Join your own local Transition Town. Start one if you don't have one in your area.